Schwarzkopf began to plan who would be immunized with the limited supplies. Months earlier, he had asked his chief medical officer, Colonel Robert Belihar, and other top aides to assess how and where Iraq might attack with germs. "Think as Saddam Hussein would," he told him. Belihar said he lacked information. Would the Iraqis use anthrax as an aerosol, or would they pour botulism into the water supplies? Would they spread germs on the front lines or use it as a terror weapon in the United States? A key question was whether Iraq had vaccinated its soldiers against anthrax or other agents. The Americans arranged for blood samples to be taken from Iraqi deserters being held by Saudi Arabia. The blood was flown to Fort Detrick for analysis in early December. Schwarzkopf and his aides eventually concluded that anthrax would most likely be aimed at rear areas. A germ weapon that takes effect over several days, they reasoned, would not be very useful in a frontal assault. Botulinum dissipates quickly and was thus a threat to the forward positions. Schwarzkopf was trying to make the best of a bad situation. It was entirely possible that his guesses were wrong, that the Iraqis would use anthrax against the front lines. If that happened, there would hardly be any vaccine left to treat those who were ill. His proposal for rationing the vaccine stirred up inter-service rivalries. At a meeting of Air Force generals in December, one officer complained that the recommendations by Schwarzkopf, an Army general, reflected an infantryman's concerns for his fellow infantrymen. The Air Force had done its own analysis, which concluded its crews would be a primary target for germ weapons. Air Force officers drew up a list of 30,000 airmen who should be vaccinated. A December 11th assessment prepared by Army health officials outlined three possible approaches. Course of action number one was to begin vaccinating U.S. troops as quickly as possible. This would have a favorable domestic reception and could deter Iraq. Course of action number two was to share the limited supplies with allies, which would promote perception of shared risk, support the unity of the alliance, and might dissuade Baghdad from using germ weapons. The third option was to defer vaccinations until there was enough on hand for a comprehensive program while sharing the antibiotics with allies. This would heighten the dangers for everyone, but the shared risk would promote allied unity and keep on hand a supply of vaccine in case of attack. Pentagon officials wrote that the last approach offered another benefit. It will temper media reaction. On December 17, 1990, Powell finally delivered his recommendations to Secretary Cheney, calling for inoculations to begin immediately. It had been 4 months since the Pentagon's medical experts had made the same proposal, months in which the service chiefs and other top military and civilian officials had undergone a crash course in the science, tactics, and ambiguities of biological warfare. Cheney and Powell took their plan to the White House. At the table were President George Bush and several of his top aides. Some were surprised by the seriousness with which the Pentagon presented the Iraqi biological threat. Was it really likely that the Iraqis would use such weapons? What were the risks of the vaccines? White House officials had made a pact among themselves. They would not micromanage. They would not overrule the commanders on purely military issues. The president approved the plan without revisions. I'll be honest, if I had been making the decision on the anthrax, I probably would not have used it, Brent Scowcroft, Bush's national security advisor, said in a recent interview. I didn't object to it if the military thought it was the thing to do, but I probably would not have recommended it. As Powell's aides were drafting the memo outlining the vaccination program, the Pentagon received an encouraging bit of news. The blood samples taken from detained Iraqi deserters showed no sign of immunizations against anthrax or botulinum. Schwarzkopf's medical team did not feel particularly relieved. The Iraqi soldiers in Saudi hands were conscripts, cannon fodder, whom Iraqi generals would view as expendable. Perhaps Saddam Hussein had vaccinated his elite troops, the Republican Guard. Maybe the Iraqis would attack the front lines with germs, killing both the unvaccinated Iraqi conscripts and the Americans. Back in Washington, the Army was pressing the FDA to permit it to give the botulinum vaccine to soldiers without obtaining the informed consent normally required for patients given experimental unapproved drugs. Botulinum's effects were felt within hours of exposure, which meant the weapon might be useful in an attack on frontline troops. There would be no time for medical niceties, military officials argued. The FDA reluctantly agreed. By December 29th, Powell notified Schwarzkopf that the decision had finally been made to immunize the troops against anthrax and botulinum. Days later, Schwarzkopf reviewed the plan for rationing the vaccine with his top aides and demanded some changes, overruling a proposal to give botulinum shots to officers at the Riyadh headquarters. What little vaccine there was, he thought, should be reserved for frontline troops. Schwarzkopf also said every soldier assigned to receive the experimental drug should be given a release form to read and sign. Anyone who wanted to refuse the shot could do so. In early January 1991, teams of medics began immunizing the troops against anthrax and botulinum. Every soldier was also issued a 5-day supply of Cipro. A Marine Corps medical official told General James M. Myatt, the leader of the 1st Marine Division, that there were only 7,000 doses of anthrax vaccine for the 22,000 soldiers under his command. Like Schwarzkopf, Myatt was reluctant to play God. If there was not enough vaccine to go around, nobody would get it. Adherence to Schwarzkopf's orders on the botulinum vaccine was spotty. Some soldiers were given the shot without being told what it was. To quell fears about the vaccines, Schwarzkopf himself took an anthrax shot. "Just make sure that I'm one of those 9 monkeys that survived," he told the medics. Detectors were still a major headache. By December, senior Army officials had devised a plan to use an untried laser-based technology to detect germ attacks. The Los Alamos National Laboratory had been experimenting with airborne lasers that might be able to pick up the release of an aerosol cloud. The lasers were to be placed aboard C-130 aircraft that would fly continuously over the Gulf. Schwarzkopf's second-in-command, General Cal Waller, hated the idea. "Thanks for your proposed deployment of experimental developmental BW defense assets," Waller wrote to the Pentagon. "The fielding of a fully supported system of operational worth on such short notice is ambitious." Waller said he was reluctant to divert his limited intelligence aircraft from priority missions to an untried, uncertain system of biological defense. The Air Force also hated the plan, fearing that the lasers might blind pilots. They were not deployed. Instead, the Army relied on a dozen detectors its technicians had improvised. The system was built around a sniffer that forced huge quantities of air into a liquid reservoir. Servicemen would test for biological attack by dipping specially treated paper into the liquid at regular intervals. In theory, the paper would change color in the presence of suspect microbes, such as the anthrax bacillus. Then the liquid would be tested with more sensitive lab equipment. No one had much confidence in the system. On December 9th, Schwarzkopf spoke with Powell by secure phone and suggested a bold tactic to avert biological attack. The United States should announce that it would severely punish Saddam Hussein if he used his chemical or biological weapons. Powell said he was pressing the White House to warn Iraq that the United States would use its own unconventional weapons if Iraq attacked with chemicals, a reference to nuclear retaliation. The consensus among Bush and his top national security aides, known as the Gang of Eight, was against such retaliation. Washington was trying to hold together a fragile coalition that included Iraq's Arab neighbors. Bush made his preferences clear. He would not be the second president in American history to order a nuclear strike. If the United States needed to punish Iraq, it would expand its conventional bombing campaign. The decision was kept secret. On January 9, 1991, Secretary of State Baker flew to Geneva to give Tariq Aziz, the Iraqi foreign minister, a letter from President Bush to Saddam Hussein. The White House had decided against threatening Iraq with nuclear attack. "Your country," the letter said, "will pay a terrible price if you order unconscionable acts." Aziz refused to accept the letter, and Baker, taking an expansive view of his instructions, set out to persuade the Iraqis that the United States was poised for nuclear retaliation. "God forbid," he said, chemical or biological weapons are used against our forces. The American people would demand revenge. Baker added, "This is not a threat." The president's inclination against a nuclear strike was hypothetical, and Pentagon officials who had done some preliminary planning of nuclear options believed that they could reopen the issue if Saddam Hussein did the unthinkable. The day after a biological strike, political pressure would force any president to reassess. "If we had a loss of 200,000 soldiers, how could we not nuke them?" asked Larry Sequist, whose report for the Pentagon's top policy officials had raised the specter of such losses. Scowcroft acknowledged that the issue would have been revisited if Americans had died in a germ attack, but he added that he would have adamantly opposed nuclear retaliation. Scowcroft said he would have strongly argued for changing the aims of the war to, say, toppling Saddam Hussein. Using atomic weapons against Iraq would have been, in his words, another case where it's okay against the Japanese, okay against the Arabs, not against white folk. In January 1991, as the Allies prepared for the ground war that would culminate with the invasion of Kuwait, Schwarzkopf's aides confronted a grisly question. If soldiers were killed by a germ attack, what should the military do with their remains? Botulinum toxin decays rapidly, so victims of that microbe could be buried in temporary graves and then exhumed for internment in the United States. Anthrax, with its highly persistent spores, was another matter. The presence of living anthrax spores in the remains can only be confidently excluded if the bodies are incinerated, a memo from Fort Detrick said. If that was not possible, the remains would have to be soaked in a powerful bleach to kill all the spores. The bones could then be flown back to the United States for burial with minimal risk to morticians. In the days before the air war began, President Bush grew increasingly anxious about Iraq's biological arsenal. On January 13th, he asked Powell to review the plans for bombing the refrigerated bunkers. What were the risks? Was it worth it? Powell reassured the president that the bombing would probably destroy the germ agents. Some might be released, but it was a gamble we had to take. In his memoirs, Powell wrote that Bush was already agitated, and this added worry did not soothe him. 2 days later, the chief of the British Defense Staff, Air Vice Marshal Sir David Craig, called with the same questions. "Bit risky, that, eh?" Craig remarked. Powell said he believed that the benefits outweighed the costs. "If it heads south," he told Craig, "just blame me." The United Nations deadline expired on January 15th. Officials later said that in the meeting in which President Bush sent American forces to war against Baghdad, he had only two concerns: a last-minute diplomatic move by France and the threat from biological weapons. At 1:30 a.m. on January 16th, the first Tomahawk cruise missiles were launched from vessels in the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf, marking the start of the largest sustained bombing campaign in the history of warfare. In Washington, the officials who had tried to build a credible defense against biological attack held their breath. Sequist believed that the United States' best defense was Iraq's fear of nuclear retaliation. But the Bush administration had undermined that strategy in the weeks leading up to the war. While administration spokesmen studiously maintained the ambiguity, Vice President Dan Quayle said that he could not imagine the president ordering a nuclear strike. The next day, Quayle said, "We don't rule options in or out." Iraq's air defenses were destroyed in the first days of the war, and Allied bombers pounded what intelligence officials believed were the key biological targets. Salman Pak, a research facility where intelligence analysts suspected that Iraq had begun its nuclear program and done some germ experiments, was leveled. Nearly all of the refrigerated bunkers were slammed with high explosives. On January 21st, the pursuit of biological targets became a major public relations problem for the Allied coalition as bombers slammed a factory in Abu Ghraib that intelligence officials believed was a backup plant for germ production. Iraq said the factory produced infant formula, and CNN's Peter Arnett was taken to the site for a tour and the chance to broadcast pictures of a container bearing, in English, the notation baby milk. Replying to some skeptical questioning from Schwarzkopf's aides after the raid, intelligence officials said they had spotted little day-to-day activity at the plant since it had opened in 1983. It produced little baby milk and was camouflaged just prior to the war, suggesting to the American analysts who were picking the targets that it was linked to biological warfare. The connection of the factory to biological weapons remains controversial. American intelligence officials scoured the region for signs of a biological release, particularly on the days after germ-related targets were hit. The DIA reported after the bombing of Salman Pak that there had been no outbreak of disease in Baghdad. Allied bombers hit another suspected germ facility at Taji on January 21st in a raid that American officials had feared could release as much as 500 grams of anthrax, killing as many as 5,000 people in Baghdad. It has been 3 days since the attack, the report noted, and casualties should already have started. The findings were immediately reported to Cheney. It looked like the Allied bombing was not going to unleash a plague on the Middle East. There were some anxious moments. A half dozen British soldiers stationed near the front lines reported flu-like symptoms. They were sent to a Saudi hospital and closely monitored. Their symptoms, it turned out, were caused by the flu. The bulky detectors picked up several signs of anthrax and botulinum, all of which were found to be false alarms. The ground attack was ready to go, and Saddam Hussein was running out of time to use his ultimate weapons. Inspection. February 28, 1991. After weeks of bombing and 100 hours of one-sided ground combat, Iraq was surrendering, its elite Republican Guard fleeing Kuwait at top speed. The doomsday scenario, nearly 200,000 Allied soldiers dying from a single devastating Iraqi anthrax attack, had turned out to be just another of those wartime contingencies. No aerosol cloud had drifted over the American forces in the desert. No suitcase-sized bombs had been detonated in the subways of Washington or New York. None of the antibiotics set aside to treat victims of a germ attack in the nation's capital had been needed. The mood among American military and national security officials in the months after the war ended was triumphant. Allied troops had demonstrated their superior technology and training, smashing a well-armed foe while sustaining hardly any casualties. Smart bombs, guided by a wisp of laser light, had homed onto targets with precision accuracy from thousands of feet away. American ingenuity appeared to have neutralized even Saddam Hussein's best terror weapon, the Scud missile, as the Patriot defense system seemingly blasted incoming rockets out of the sky. With President George Bush's popularity soaring above 90%, the only controversy was over whether the Allied forces had killed too many Iraqi soldiers. The biological arsenal that had worried General Powell and the president before the bombing began in January seemed a footnote, a historical curiosity. American intelligence officials poring over satellite photos of Iraq believed that the Allied bombing had demolished Saddam Hussein's germ operations. A secret March 1991 study by the Defense Intelligence Agency said it would cost up to $200 million and take as long as 8 years for Iraq to rebuild its germ factories and laboratories. The bombing had destroyed all known Iraqi facilities for researching or producing bioagents, the DIA said. Over time, a more accurate picture emerged. The footage of smart bombs turned out to be misleading. Many targets had been missed. The anti-missile defenses were not nearly as effective as they had appeared on CNN. Most, if not all, of the Iraqi Scud attacks had evaded the Patriot system. And perhaps most important, Iraq had built and concealed a germ arsenal that was far larger and far more lethal than anyone had understood, a sprawling complex of buildings and laboratories that had survived the war largely intact. But no one knew that in the early days of 1991. Iraq's failure to use its biological weapons gave powerful new arguments to those who believed the germ threat was overstated. Deterrence appeared to have worked. Secretary of State James Baker's veiled threat of nuclear retaliation had proven an effective defense, staying Saddam Hussein's hand. Hardly anyone inside or outside government knew the full story about the extent of the Iraqi threat or the lack of effective defensive preparations. The pre-war intelligence reports about Iraq's program, the Pentagon's frantic, unsuccessful attempts to produce enough vaccine for its troops, General Schwarzkopf's fury over the choices he was forced to make, all remained closely guarded secrets. Key documents spelling out the military's vulnerabilities were never provided to Congress or widely distributed within the government. Some details, such as precisely how little vaccine the United States produced during the war, are still classified as secret a decade later. On April 4, 1991, the United Nations Security Council pledged to lift the international ban on Iraqi oil sales as soon as it confirmed that Baghdad had destroyed its biological, nuclear, and chemical weapons. To American officials, the arrangement seemed more than fair. Iraq had already agreed to give up its unconventional weapons in the resolution ending the war. The profits from the Iraqi crude would help Baghdad repair the damage caused by Allied bombing. American and European companies would win lucrative contracts to rebuild Iraq. The region would be more secure. And the Iraqi leaders who benefited personally from each oil sale would have more money to divide among themselves. Everyone would come out a winner. What seemed clear in Washington and London was less obvious in Baghdad. Iraq's influence in the region stemmed from its ability to bully its neighbors, from Jordan to Kuwait to the tiny states scattered across the Gulf. To the Iraqis, the benefits of keeping their germ, chemical, and nuclear programs alive were substantial, even at the risk of losing billions of dollars in oil revenues. The bugs were their atom bomb. Even if the biological weapons were never used, the rumors of their existence could make little nations take note and might give Western powers reason to pause. Soon after the war ended, Iraq's foreign minister, Tariq Aziz, ordered top officials to prepare plans for hiding the weapons infrastructure from the United Nations. Iraq would not disclose its nuclear or biological programs or its stocks of VX, an advanced nerve agent. It would conceal all evidence of the germ operations and of the crashed nuclear program, which had come much closer to building a crude nuclear bomb than Western intelligence officials suspected. Iraqi officials destroyed documents, built fake walls in key buildings, and rehearsed the lies they planned to offer United Nations arms inspectors. On April 18, 1991, Iraq delivered its first official statement to the UN on its unconventional weapons. It acknowledged limited production of chemical weapons and did not mention work on either nuclear or biological weapons. The job of verifying that statement fell to a new group of experts, the United Nations Special Commission. Known by its acronym, UNSCOM, the organization was unlike any the world had ever seen, a mix of diplomats and specialists who had been Cold War adversaries. Retired Soviet military officers worked with their counterparts from the American and British military. The UN Security Council picked Rolf Ekéus, a Swedish diplomat and former judge, as UNSCOM's leader. Ekéus felt he did not have much to go on in pursuing Iraq's biological weapons. There were no signposts, no hints. Baghdad had made some significant admissions about its chemical and missile programs. Ekéus's initial view was that Iraq had filed a relatively honest declaration that needed to be verified. He immediately wrote a letter to 50 nations around the world from which Iraq might have bought chemical, nuclear, or biological equipment, asking for help. Only Britain and the United States replied with detailed information. American officials provided a briefing to the UN team in early May, but the CIA was reluctant to share its best information with an international group that included former Soviet officials and that was wide open to compromise by Iraqi spies. Although British and American inspectors were privately given more information, the intelligence agencies were circumspect about what they said, even to allies. On August 2, 1991, UNSCOM's first biological inspections team arrived in Baghdad. It would take the United Nations teams nearly 4 years and countless trips to Iraq to piece together what the CIA had figured out by the fall of 1991. In the years that followed their first trip to Al-Hakam, inspectors disagreed about whether Iraq even had a bioweapons program. One member of the team in particular saw missed opportunities in the CIA reports. David Kelly, a microbiologist and top British specialist on germ weapons, pointed out that the first UNSCOM inspection in November 1991 was a cursory look for bunkers. Having the complete report from the spy in 1991 would have prompted the field teams to ask much tougher questions, to look harder. It would have affected the investigation profoundly, he said. Ekias, who refereed the fights among UNSCOM inspectors over Iraq's biological capabilities, could only shake his head when shown the CIA material 10 years later. "This is scandalous," he said. "Yes, it definitely would have mattered." As UNSCOM inspectors struggled to decipher the Iraqi germ program, the Pentagon began work on rebuilding America's biological defenses. Army officials were persuaded by their Gulf War experiences that neither private industry nor Michigan could be relied upon to make sufficient quantities of vaccine in times of war. The Defense Department, the Army said, should immediately begin work on its own vaccine plant. Coalition warfare was the way of the future, and the United States should have enough vaccine to supply not only its own needs, but those of select allies. A contractor could be hired to run the factory. On April 9, 1991, Colin Powell and the Joint Chiefs of Staff agreed to a first step, recommending that the Army stockpile enough anthrax vaccine to protect the entire active duty force of 1.6 million men and women. Powell outlined the proposal in a secret memo to Defense Secretary Cheney. He termed it a minimal goal. The Army's plan to vaccinate a limited number of soldiers in peacetime proved far more contentious. By the fall of 1991, the demise of communism was stirring serious demands for a peace dividend. As the White House scoured the Pentagon for budget cuts, the Army, Air Force, and Navy all fought to save their favorite projects. Every dollar for biological defense was a dollar taken away from other programs that had long enjoyed greater stature. The Army's vaccine factory would cost more than $1 billion over several years. At an October 1991 meeting of the chiefs, the Air Force asked whether the threat was real and whether the Pentagon could afford such an ambitious plan. Cheney's aides had qualms about some aspects of the Army proposal, but insisted to military leaders that two components of the plan, peacetime vaccinations and adequate vaccine production, should be accomplished immediately. The services did not agree. "There is a lack of consensus on the threat," one official wrote in February 1992. "Navy and Air Force do not see the same threat to their forces as ground forces." As a result, there was no vaccination policy. The Air Force and Navy suggested inoculating troops on the eve of hostilities and only if they were going to war against a foe known to have germ weapons. Health officials said such a plan was medically unsound. They reminded Powell that it takes as long as 6 months to build up full immunity. The chairman began quietly pushing the plan to begin peacetime vaccinations of selected units. British and American efforts to force Moscow to own up to its biological past appeared to be making progress. Boris Yeltsin, who became president of Russia after the Soviet Union ceased to exist on December 31, 1991, told President Bush at a February 1992 summit meeting at Camp David that he had personally reviewed the issue. He expressed his own doubts about Sverdlovsk and promised Bush, "I will issue a decree and clean this up." In passing, Yeltsin mentioned some alarming news to his American hosts. His own military was holding back from his aides information about the illicit program. As the summit concluded, a Russian spokesman publicly announced Yeltsin's pledges to dismantle the Soviet Germ Empire. A confrontation, however, soon erupted over whether Moscow had been candid about its germ history. Britain, the United States, and Russia had agreed to make declarations to the United Nations about their respective programs. Russia's proposed draft, circulated in late April 1992, disappointed officials on both sides of the Atlantic. It did not acknowledge any weapons production and omitted many of the facilities Pasechnik had disclosed. The account, one official said, was the diplomatic equivalent of saying, "I smoked, but I didn't inhale." Later that year, British, American, and Russian officials gathered in Moscow for talks that quickly grew tense. The talks dragged into a second day, and in the final hours, the Russians delivered an ultimatum. Moscow would agree to visits to suspect biological facilities, but only if the United States and Britain agreed to open their pharmaceutical companies to the same scrutiny. The British and American officials hated the offer because it made all three sides appear equally culpable. But diplomacy is the art of the possible. They accepted the deal, which was announced with great fanfare and sold to Congress as a diplomatic accomplishment. Within weeks, as the negotiations for the mutual inspections plodded ahead, the United States unexpectedly learned even more about the extent of Moscow's biological deceit. Tired of what he saw as the timidity and inaction at Fort Detrick, Bill Patrick quit his Army job in 1986 soon after helping the FBI investigate the Rajneeshi assault in Oregon. He was 59 but called himself an old fossil, wedded to germ weapons. Sure that the threat was rising, Patrick set up a germ warfare consulting firm that targeted federal agencies and private clients. His business card bore a skull and crossbones. In 1992, Patrick got a visit from the CIA. The CIA men walked Bill Patrick into the middle of his yard in rural Maryland, away from possible surveillance in the house. They told him that they wanted him to interview a Soviet defector. He got into a government car and was driven around for a long time to elude any tail. Finally, at a secluded spot near Washington, they arrived at the safe house. Patrick was surprised that the Russian defector looked so Asiatic. The chauvinistic Soviet system usually reserved top posts for ethnic Russians. Even so, the short man, born in Kazakhstan, was allegedly a scientist who had worked for 17 years inside the Soviet biological weapons program. He'd risen to become the second in command of something called Biopreparat, which American intelligence agencies had been tracking for years. If real, he was better than Pasechnik, a leader with a detailed overview of the whole clandestine effort. Now it was up to Patrick to test the defector's credibility and see what he might have to offer. Patrick handed the defector his business card, the one with the skull and crossbones. The defector couldn't read a word of English, but he laughed. The ice was broken. "We got right down to it," Patrick recalled. This defector was the real thing, someone who knew the intricacies of the art. "I won't say we fell in love," Patrick recalled, "but we gained an immediate respect for one another." The defector was Kanatyan Alabekov, who later changed his name to Ken Alabek to make it sound more American. What Alabek had to say was horrifying. Moscow, he reported in grim detail, had secretly produced hundreds of tons of anthrax, smallpox, and plague germs meant for use against the United States and its allies. The amounts dwarfed anything American experts had ever imagined. Alabek also described a germ empire that stretched from the Soviet Council of Ministers to the Soviet Academy of Sciences through the Ministries of Defense, Health, and Agriculture, and into Biopreparat, his own ostensibly civilian pharmaceutical agency. In fact, Alabek said, Biopreparat was a biological war machine that employed tens of thousands of people at more than 40 sites spread across Russia and Kazakhstan. Most important for Patrick, Alabek related details of the Soviet scientific work. As Pasechnik had first revealed in 1989, The germ recipes developed by Moscow drew on many different breakthroughs of the biological revolution that had begun just after Washington's own germ program was shut down in 1969. Patrick buried his head in his hands. The Soviets had made significant advances. The secret debriefings, begun in late 1992, went on for 1 year. Allebeck's assertions were greeted with some skepticism by the broader intelligence community. It wasn't that anybody doubted that the Soviet Union had built a large germ arsenal, but there were questions about the details, especially Allebeck's assessment of the Soviets' successes in recombinant research. Over time, Allebeck's statements to the Americans included both firsthand knowledge and his interpretation of what Russian scientists were publishing in the open literature. Allebeck was a medical doctor, some analysts grumbled, and out of his depth on hard science. But with Patrick as his new ally, he continued to raise the alarm about Russia's germ achievements, first in the secret councils of government, then eventually in public. Bill Clinton took office in January 1993, determined to keep foreign affairs in the background, which quickly proved impossible. The Soviet menace was gone, but the end of the Cold War had brought new dangers. Clinton was a quick study, and he understood when aides identified a new kind of threat. The thousands of Soviet scientists left unemployed and bitter by the collapse of their country. Many had spent their lives producing biological, chemical, or nuclear weapons. Their recruitment by a rogue nation or terrorist group could threaten the United States and its allies. The new president had been in office just 35 days when he was confronted with an attack on American soil. Islamic radicals exploded a bomb under the World Trade Center in New York City, shaking it with the force of a small earthquake, collapsing walls and floors, igniting fires, and plunging the city's largest building complex into smoke and darkness. The blast killed 6 people and injured roughly 1,000. President Clinton and his aides came to believe that the United States was vulnerable to even more devastating assaults. The attack on the Twin Towers by a loosely organized group of people who had fought against the Soviets in Afghanistan marked a fundamental shift in the nature of terrorism. For much of the 20th century, ethnic groups had used bombings and assassinations in their fight for independence and their own nation-states. The World Trade Center attack reflected a new paradigm, a holy war, with the United States cast as the enemy. Some of the more violent groups were underwritten by a wealthy Saudi exile, Osama bin Laden, who hoped to spread his radical vision of Islamic rule to Muslims everywhere and drive the United States out of the Middle East and Africa. Clinton's choice as defense secretary, Les Aspin, understood the biological issue. A respected military thinker, Aspin had served for years as chairman of the House Armed Services Committee and had studied the Persian Gulf conflict closely. The central lesson, he believed, was that American military power would not deter dictators like Saddam Hussein from seemingly irrational acts. Aspin argued that American forces would have to be ready to counter whatever an adversary could invent, including chemical and biological weapons. Early in Aspin's tenure, Army officials pressed their case for building a modern government-owned pharmaceutical facility where the military could produce large quantities of several different vaccines. Surveys of the nation's pharmaceutical companies, they wrote, had found no commercial interest in making vaccine for biodefense. The officials added that the burgeoning research into recombinant bacteria and viruses raised the threat of new kinds of weapons. Construction of the plant was slated to begin in early 1994. If all went well, the facility, equipped with 6 separate production suites for making different vaccines, would produce its first lots in 1998. Army officials hoped it would eventually make 17 different vaccines. A fight soon erupted over who would be in charge of making the military's vaccines. For years, biological defenses had been divided between the Army's Chemical Corps, which handled suits and detectors, and the Army's Medical Research and Development Command at Fort Detrick, which managed vaccine programs. Aspin's aides believed biodefenses would be stronger if all the projects were guided by a single hand. It made no sense, they felt, to buy biological detectors in one corner of the Army and vaccine in another. The medical command, the Army docs, as they were called, lobbied against the idea, arguing that while the merger looked logical on paper, it would be disastrous in practice. While some in the military referred to chem-bio as a single threat, the two disciplines were very different. Because the bulk of the spending on biodefense went for detectors, the leader of a new joint office would inevitably come from the chemical corps. Vaccine production, the docs argued, should be overseen by someone with a biology background. The former head of the Army's Medical Research Command, Philip Russell, asked Lederberg to intercede with John Deutsch, the former MIT chemistry professor who was the Pentagon's top procurement official. Deutsch was unmoved. The Chemical Corps officers were more experienced at buying military equipment. They were perfectly capable of managing vaccine projects, Deutsch believed. In June 1993, the Pentagon created the Joint Program Office for Biological Defense. As the military made plans for stronger germ defenses, Josh Lederberg grew increasingly anxious about the threat posed by impoverished germ scientists, especially in Russia and the former Soviet republics. They might be tempted to sell their expertise to rogue states or terrorist groups, he worried. A breakthrough came in 1993. During the previous decade, the National Academy of Sciences, the nation's preeminent scientific group, had established a committee of top American scientists that met regularly with Soviet counterparts to discuss security issues. Lederberg was a member. A 1993 meeting of the Joint Committee in Moscow had a surreal air as the Russian biologists denied that they had ever done anything wrong, contradicting Pasechnik, Alabek, and even Yeltsin. Finally, Lev S. Sandakchev, the director of the State Research Center of Virology and Biotechnology, known as Vector, stood up. "Let's cut the crap," he said. "The past had to be acknowledged," he declared, alluding to what he and his colleagues had long denied. Sandakchev, of course, knew what he was talking about. His own giant institute in remote Siberia had specialized in turning the world's deadliest viruses into weapons. Lederberg was stunned. The candor, he recalled, continued in the months ahead as both sides discussed the deteriorating state of the former Soviet germ warfare centers and what could be done to keep their secrets and scientists from falling into unfriendly hands. Lederberg proposed closer ties. His idea was to use Defense Department funds to pay former Soviet biowarriors to do peaceful research at home in cooperation with American scientists. Under a law sponsored by Senator Sam Nunn, Democrat of Georgia, and Senator Richard Lugar, Republican of Indiana, Congress for 2 years had been providing defense funds to help former Soviet states dismantle their nuclear warheads. Lederberg and his allies wanted Nunn-Lugar funds extended to biologists and the Academy to organize the cooperative program. The Pentagon resisted. Military officials argued that biological projects would be inherently for dual use, aiding the development not only of medicine but also of weapons. The uneasiness was most intense among American military scientists, especially some at Fort Detrick, who feared that their collaborations with the Russians would be attacked as aiding Moscow's development of germ weapons. But Lederberg strongly disagreed. He argued that the projects could be screened carefully to minimize the military risk. He had great credibility at the Pentagon, an Academy official recalled. He could address those kinds of issues with more authority than anybody else. Lederberg won, and the Defense Department began to finance cooperative projects. For instance, it paid for a Dietrich scientist to work with Russian scientists at Vector. The team analyzed the genome of the monkeypox virus, a cousin to smallpox. Lederberg became chairman of an Academy committee that advised the Pentagon on the safety of the Russian research proposals. Among the committee's 14 members was Matt Meselson, the Harvard biologist. While Meselson and Lederberg were developing somewhat different views on Moscow's biological past, they agreed on the value of the cooperative projects. In the summer of 1993, Lederberg began urging the Pentagon to broaden its biodefense agenda to include civilians but the military was having enough trouble addressing its own needs. On November 26, 1993, the Pentagon committed to its first peacetime vaccination program against biowarfare agents. The order was signed by William J. Perry, then the Deputy Secretary of Defense. It directed the nation's armed services to inoculate personnel stationed in high-threat areas, or those who were assigned to units that would be mobilized first in a crisis. The Pentagon, it said, must improve existing vaccines, develop new ones, and stockpile supplies to protect soldiers against all possible biological threats identified by the intelligence agencies. Powell had finally persuaded military leaders to begin inoculations against biological attack before a war broke out. Producing the vaccines would be challenging. A design for the Army's proposed factory was complete, and sites were being scouted at Pine Bluff, Arkansas, and Fort Detrick. But congressional opposition was growing. In the fall of 1993, lawmakers ordered the Army to stop work until it completed a study justifying the need for a new government-owned facility. The issue came before John Deutsch, who was then the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition. Several civilian officials argued that the military had no reason to get into the drug business. But the Army docs pleaded with Deutsch to keep the factory alive, even if that meant a fight with Congress. Deutsch was strongly inclined to leave vaccines to the private sector. The Army docs, he felt, had a poor track record in moving from research to manufacturing. The factory was a substantial investment, $200 million, but Deutsch saw the question as a straightforward procurement issue. How could the military most efficiently buy its vaccines? He had spoken with pharmaceutical executives who were willing to take on the work if the government insulated them from legal liability. The Army's plans for a vaccine factory were shelved. Pentagon officials began searching for a prime contractor to manage the development of new vaccines. For the foreseeable future, the military would rely on the Michigan lab for its anthrax shots. The Army projected that it could stockpile enough to protect every serviceman by 1997, but only if Michigan doubled its production without a hitch, and only if the FDA accepted a proposal to lower the number of shots required from 6 to 5. Josh Lederberg continued to raise the alarm about civilian vulnerabilities. In May 1994, the New York City Health Commissioner, Margaret A. Hamburg, arranged for him to brief Mayor Rudolph W. Giuliani on the biological threat. A former prosecutor, Giuliani had begun to grasp the political impact of public health issues when the New York City tabloids broke the story of an 8-year-old killed by a rare form of virulent streptococcus. Some parents panicked. There were calls to close every school where a child had strep throat, a move, Hamburg noted, that would have shut down every school. The incident, she recalled, marked the first time that Giuliani understood how unsettling an invisible infectious disease can be to a population. The mayor was behind schedule, so the briefing began in the early evening. Lederberg offered a tutorial on the life cycle of the anthrax bug. Hamburg was dismayed. At the end of a long day, the mayor could not possibly be interested in such particulars. "The mayor's going to kill me," she remembered thinking. But Giuliani loved it. They went into all kinds of detail. How many spores could you get into a light bulb? That kind of thing. It went on for 2 hours. A few weeks later, Lederberg was seated next to Anthony Lake, President Clinton's national security advisor, at a dinner meeting in New York at the Council on Foreign Relations. He told Lake that the administration was not doing enough to defend Americans against germ weapons. "Do I really have to worry about this?" Lake asked. "I've got enough on my plate right now." "Yeah, I really think we do," Lederberg replied. He followed up the exchange with a letter on June 11, 1994, recounting his meetings with the Bush White House during the Gulf War. "The result was at least a skeletal framework for coordination," he wrote, "that has largely evaporated." Lederberg said that biological weapons were already widely proliferated and that New York City and Washington are the world's juiciest targets for such attacks. On Sunday evening, March 19, 1995, wire services began sending urgent bulletins from Japan saying thousands of people had been sickened in the subways during their Monday morning commute by a mysterious gas or toxin. The Aum Shinrikyo Group, an obscure religious cult, had released sarin gas in the subway system. The death toll would reach 6, with thousands sickened. As the administration scrambled to respond, it quickly became clear that neither the CIA nor the FBI knew much about Aum Shinrikyo, or had any idea why it might try to kill thousands of Japanese commuters. It took American officials several years to pry details about Aum Shinrikyo's operations from the reluctant Japanese police. The group, officials would learn, was a religious cult with a $1 billion war chest and an apocalyptic theology that sanctioned mass killing. Evidence emerged over several years that scientists working for Aum had tried several times to make germ weapons from anthrax and botulinum. They had staged as many as a dozen unsuccessful germ attacks in Japan from 1990 to 1995. The cult had tens of thousands of members in Russia and Japan, had published a statement threatening President Clinton, and hoped to hasten Armageddon by sparking a war between Russia and the United States. On a radio program it sponsored in Russia, it had broadcast statements touting the virtues of biological weapons. The 1995 subway gassings changed the thinking of many American officials. Richard A. Clark, the White House official who handled terrorism issues, had put together a counterterrorism group which had recently begun planning defenses against terrorists who might use chemicals or germs to achieve their ends. But until CNN flashed around the world the footage of Japanese commuters dying in Tokyo, it was seen as a remote possibility. Before Aum, the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center by Islamic extremists was the model for modern terrorism. The technology to produce explosives from fertilizer could be mastered by a high school chemistry student. Few experts knew the full story of the Salmonella attack carried out a decade earlier by disciples of the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. Scientists, worried about copycats, were still arguing over whether it was appropriate to publish a detailed account of the Oregon poisonings when the Aum attack occurred. The United States had set up a team to deal with nuclear terrorism in 1975 after an extortionist had threatened to explode a nuclear device in Boston. It was called the Nuclear Emergency Search Team. No similar unit existed to deal with chemical or biological terrorism aimed at civilians. On April 19, 1995, a month after Aum's attack in Tokyo, the Clinton administration was staggered by the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrow Federal Building in Oklahoma City. The attack killed nearly 200 people, including many children. Days later, the FBI began investigating a videotape that warned of a chemical attack against visitors to Disneyland over Easter weekend. The tape showed hands mixing chemicals. Federal agents swarmed over the amusement park. The person or persons who sent the tape were never found. On June 21, 1995, President Clinton signed a secret directive on counterterrorism, the results of a far-reaching review that had begun 2 years earlier after the World Trade Center bombing. Presidential Decision Directive 39 delineated the agencies that were to play the lead roles in handling terrorist incidents. The State Department overseas and the FBI inside the United States. Clinton ordered the Federal Emergency Management Agency to update its planning for terrorism involving weapons of mass destruction. Tacked on just before Clinton's signature was a sentence drafted by Dick Clark. The United States shall give highest priority to developing effective capabilities to detect, prevent, defeat, and manage the consequences of a nuclear, biological, or chemical materials or weapons use by terrorists. A few days later, nearly 400 officials from the United States, Canada, Britain, and Japan met in Bethesda, Maryland, for a closed-door seminar on how those words might be turned into reality. Health and Human Services officials had planned the three-day meeting long before the Tokyo subway gassing, but Aum Shinrikyo was weighing heavily on the minds of everyone who attended. Philip C. Wilcox, Jr., the State Department's coordinator for counterterrorism, told a packed auditorium, "The copycat phenomenon, which we worry about a great deal in counterterrorism, is a real risk here. Once it has happened, others will take their cue and try it again. Once the barrier has been breached, what was originally unthinkable now becomes more likely." Several leading scientists spoke to the group, including Josh Lederberg. But it was Bill Patrick's presentation that provided some of the most chilling moments of the three-day meeting. Speaking in his usual relaxed, conversational tone, he detailed how a terrorist could mount a germ attack on the World Trade Center using a blender, cheesecloth, a garden sprayer, and some widely available hospital supplies. Patrick gave several scenarios, including an attack with Francisella tularensis, a favorite agent of the defunct American offensive program and a germ that the Rajneeshis had ordered. It would take the terrorist about 36 hours to brew 5 liters of bacterial solution containing swarms of germs, about 500 million cells per milliliter. An infectious dose of the bacteria, Patrick said, was about 50 cells per milliliter. A terrorist who loaded the mixture into a garden sprayer, then aimed that sprayer at the building's air intakes, would, in a few minutes, disseminate enough agent to infect half the people in the World Trade Center. Patrick said, "My conclusion today is not if terrorists will use a biological weapon, but when and where." There were few questions after the retired germ scientist finished his presentation. No one seemed to know what to say. One official asked if there was anything local authorities could do to protect Americans other than foiling terrorists before they could attack. How do we react to something like this when and if an event occurs? "If it is an honest-to-goodness terrorist who knows what he is doing," Patrick replied, "your probability of defeating him is very slim." Evil Empire. Finally, after 4 years of denials and deception, Iraq finally conceded. At an evening meeting on July 1, 1995, Rihab Taha, the Iraqi scientist assigned to escort the inspectors, acknowledged that Baghdad had produced thousands of gallons of anthrax and botulinum at Hao Hakam. The strain of the past few months had been crushing as the unscum inspectors tore apart Iraq's cover stories. "She knew that we knew she was lying," one inspector recalled. Iraq's admissions were summarized in a 3-page document that Taha read aloud to the inspectors. She made no eye contact, staring at the ground or the papers before her. "Iraq began its biological weapons program in 1988, she said, just as the Iran-Iraq war was winding down. When the fighting ended, instructions came to keep the project going, but without rush. Production of germ agents began in 1989. She said the anthrax and botulinum were stored in stainless steel tanks in a warehouse. According to Taha, the stockpiles were destroyed in September or October of 1990 at the order of superior authorities, who feared Allied forces might bomb Iraq's scientific laboratories. The new account raised as many questions as it answered. It gave no hint as to who in the Iraqi leadership had directed the germ effort, and the weapons inspectors seriously doubted the claims that the anthrax and botulinum had never been poured into bombs or warheads. It was highly implausible that Saddam Hussein would go to the trouble of producing biological weapons only to destroy them on the eve of the mother of all battles. A month later, on August 4th, Iraq submitted a full, final, and complete disclosure on its biological weapons programs, the latest of a long series of such disclosures. 4 days later, on August 8th, the man who had run Iraq's biological weapons program for most of the last decade defected to Jordan after a family quarrel. Lieutenant General Hussein Kamel, a son-in-law of Saddam Hussein, was by far the highest-level Iraqi official to abandon the inner circle. The UN detectives finally had their own germ defector. Iraq did not wait for Kamel to expose the inaccuracies in the August 4th declaration. Hours after he fled the country, Iraqi officials informed the UN that they had discovered a cache of documents hidden on a chicken farm owned by Kamel. Iraqi officials assumed, incorrectly as it turned out, that Kamel was confessing all to UNSCOM. The Iraqis immediately came forward with a new story. Iraq, they acknowledged, had weaponized its germs. The program had been run by Kamel, who, they said, had directed a wide-ranging conspiracy after the war to conceal the germ effort from the United Nations. Iraqi officials said the president's powerful relative had barred them from telling the truth. Iraq invited UNSCOM's Ekias to the farm where the documents had been discovered to examine the evidence. Officials steered him to a small shack which contained a pile of wooden and metal boxes. A bright orange photo album was resting on top of one of the boxes. Although the room was coated with grime, there was not a speck of dust on the album, which contained detailed records of Iraq's field tests of germ weapons. The album appeared to be a briefing book for top officials. The box beneath the album, a trove of valuable documents on Iraq's germ program, included a sign-out sheet for the album. It bore the signature of Taha next to the date September 13, 1990, 6 weeks after Iraq had seized Kuwait. A flood of disclosures followed the stage-managed discovery at the chicken farm. Iraqi officials admitted that they had produced an extensive array of germ weapons for use on the battlefield, from missiles to bombs to jet-mounted aerosol tanks. They said they had produced the germs over several years, but had started a crash program to put them into weapons after August 1990, when Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait. General Schwarzkopf had been right to worry. The Iraqis told UNSCOM that they'd begun production on botulinum in January 1989, and by August 1990 had made a staggering 13,600 liters, 3,600 gallons, enough to fill a large swimming pool. Between June and December 1990, they'd had turned out 8,350 liters, 2,200 gallons of anthrax. A second production line for botulinum was begun in November, just as Allied forces were massing in the desert. By December, it had produced an additional 5,400 liters, 1,400 gallons of the toxin. All told, the Iraqis had made enough germs and toxins to kill every human being on the planet. Neither of these production sites was bombed by the Allies, who had taken them for agricultural or pharmaceutical facilities. Iraq acknowledged that its weapons specialists had tested and produced artillery shells, bombs, and missile warheads that could deliver the germs. The work had begun in 1988 when scientists had tried out an airborne bomb on a test range, killing animals with a cloud of botulinum. A few months later, in July 1988, the scientists had performed several tests with an aerosol generator hung from a Soviet-made military helicopter, using bacteria that simulate the characteristics of anthrax. The invasion of Kuwait, Iraq admitted, gave the weapons work added urgency. In the fall of 1989, Iraqi technicians had developed a new bomb, a biological version of an airplane-delivered munition that floated to Earth with a parachute. The Iraqis had coated the insides of an R-400 bomb and filled some with anthrax and others with botulinum. Iraq said it had made 100 bombs with botulinum, 50 with anthrax. The Iraqi technicians also converted some chemical warheads designed for the long-range Scud missiles to carry biological agents. Iraqi officials said they had filled 25 warheads, 16 with botulinum, 5 with anthrax, and 4 with aflatoxin, a poison from a fungus that causes long-term liver damage. The germ team also made a 2,000-liter tank that could spray anthrax or botulinum from a jet aircraft. American experts considered this one of the most threatening of the Iraqi systems. "The bombs and missiles were crude," said one official, "but this would have worked." Iraq also said its scientists had begun experimenting with viruses in July 1990, shortly before the invasion of Kuwait. These included camel pox, a relative of smallpox, hemorrhagic conjunctivitis, which causes temporary blindness, and rotavirus, which causes severe diarrhea. The Iraqis said none of these had been produced in large quantities. Shortly before the Allied bombing began, Iraq said its military officers buried 10 of the biological warheads in an abandoned railway tunnel and hid 15 more in pits next to the Tigris River. The aerial bombs, the R-400s, had been distributed around the country. Iraq disclosed that 157 of them were buried near the Azizia firing range and a military landing strip the Iraqis called Airfield 37. On the eve of the Gulf War, in December 1990 and January 1991, Iraqi pilots tested the spray tanks in their fighter planes at the Abu Ubaidi Air Base. Iraq claimed that it had destroyed all of its bombs and warheads in the summer of 1991, but provided no evidence. Iraqi officials offered conflicting explanations of why they had produced a germ arsenal. Chemical and biological weapons, they said, could be used to counter a numerically superior force. Iraqi field commanders also had the authority during the Gulf War to launch a retaliatory germ strike in the event of a nuclear attack that destroyed Baghdad. UNSCOM noted dryly that this does not exclude other possible doctrines for using biological weapons. The Iraqis' account of their program and where they hid their biological weapons matched the information obtained by the CIA in the summer of 1991. The CIA's spy, or spies, had correctly identified three of the four locales in which Baghdad had buried its germ arms. The CIA reports had pointed to Al-Hakam and Fudulaya, two of the places where Iraq operated production facilities. Even the account of the bomb sizes appeared to match the Iraqi disclosure. Iraq said it had poured its germ agent into R-400 bombs, which had a capacity of about 90 liters, and into warheads for the Scud missile, which held 145 liters, just as the CIA reports had said. How much of a threat were the Iraqi germ weapons? Years later, American intelligence officials still struggled to answer the question. Baghdad told UNSCOM that the anthrax and botulinum produced at Al-Hakam were liquid, the most primitive form of biological weapons. Iraq had rushed biological bombs to several military airfields just before the war began, but the Iraqi R-400 was a highly inefficient way to deliver death. Most of the pathogens were killed when its conventional explosive detonated. The UNSCOM team was more impressed with the aerosol generators and spray tanks. If the Iraqi pilots had been able to evade the Allied air defenses, they could have carried out a significant attack. If Iraq ever resumed making germ weapons, they would surely be much more deadly. Even as the extent of Iraq's deadly research was coming to light, officials in Washington were still struggling to make the case for anthrax vaccinations. On July 25th, Stephen Joseph, the Pentagon's top civilian health official, sent Admiral Owens, the vice chief of staff, a memo assuring him the vaccine was both safe and effective. Admiral William Owens, one of the Pentagon's most innovative thinkers, was skeptical of the push to vaccinate select troops against anthrax. He had an array of arguments against the program. The vaccinations would be militarily useless. If the United States inoculated its forces against anthrax, he told colleagues, adversaries would just shift to botulinum or some other agent. Anthrax vaccinations would complicate the delicate diplomacy of coalition building. How could the United States persuade allies with unprotected troops to join an international alliance as it had for the Gulf War? More fundamentally, Owens believed that inoculations would touch off a biological arms race. Joseph's memo sought to overcome some of Owens' objections. The files at Fort Detrick and the FDA, he said, contained no reports of serious injury caused by the vaccine. Some people had suffered mild to moderate side effects, but they were temporary, comparable to those seen with children's vaccines. Joseph assured Owens that the Michigan vaccine worked well against the aerosolized form of anthrax. Data from animal studies, he said, is quite convincing that the anthrax vaccine is an efficacious product. The memo left some things unsaid. An unvarnished accounting of the vaccine's drawbacks and selling points would have taken up many more pages and would have given Owens a lot more ammunition to fight the program. In fact, there were some questions about whether the Michigan vaccine was effective against the full array of anthrax strains available to germ warriors. While the vaccine had performed well on rhesus monkeys in the fall of 1990, a number of other studies on guinea pigs and mice had found less impressive survival rates, as low as 10% with some strains of anthrax. In early 1995, as the debate in the Pentagon over the program was heating up, Army officers circulated a proposal to start work on a new genetically engineered anthrax vaccine. Recent reports, it said, suggest that the existing vaccine may not provide universal protection against all strains. Questions of vaccine efficacy are inherently difficult to settle. The lethal nature of anthrax precluded testing on people, and no reliable animal model had been found. Immune systems of primates, mice, and guinea pigs resembled those of human beings, but researchers at Fort Detrick were still looking for ways to achieve a more precise correlation. Admiral Owens' qualms about the safety of the anthrax vaccine came at a time when Persian Gulf War veterans were growing increasingly concerned about their health. Thousands of servicemen were reporting systemic illnesses with a host of mysterious symptoms, from memory loss to muscle and joint pain. Doctors could find no immediate cause, and Joseph suspected that much of the sickness stemmed from combat stress. The veterans insisted that their illnesses were caused by the medicines they were given, the air they breathed, or, perhaps, exposure to low levels of Iraqi biological or chemical weapons. Some blamed the anthrax inoculation. There was no evidence that the Michigan vaccine had ever caused such long-term problems. But if the military were challenged on this, it would have difficulty defending its position, because such poor records had been kept of who received the anthrax and botulinum shots during the war, it would be difficult, perhaps impossible, to conduct a scientifically valid long-term study of their effects. One of Owen's closest colleagues directly opposed his position on vaccinations. Richard Danzig was Undersecretary of the Undersecretaries are typically assigned to deal with the day-to-day business of running their services, budgets, base closings, and maintenance. But Danzig, who had been a partner What kind of Navy did the United States need in the post-Cold War world? What threats were being ignored? Danzig's attention turned almost immediately to the dangers of germ weapons. Danzig's staff scoured the intelligence agencies and government medical institutes for analysts and outside experts who understood biological weapons. He told them that he wanted to get smart on the intricacies of germ warfare, how the agents really worked, what it took to disseminate them, what kind of defenses the United States could deploy. One of the scientists Danzig turned to was Josh Lederberg, whom he knew casually from his days as a Stanford University law professor. Lederberg was a brilliant analyst and conceptualizer. His ideas were often decades ahead of the conventional wisdom, but he was not much of a showman, Danzig thought. His explanations of the biological threat could be pedantic, dense with details that overwhelmed his audience. Lederberg's main problem, Danzig concluded, was that nobody was working the bureaucracy from the inside. It was a job Danzig relished. He had begun his second stint at the Pentagon with a clear sense of how to change entrenched bureaucracies. You had to sell the leadership on new ideas, take them on an intellectual journey. From conversations with experts and intelligence officers, Danzig assembled a detailed presentation on the threat posed by biological weapons. He began meeting with top civilian and military leaders from all the services, 10 or 12 people at a time. Using the Socratic method he favored as a professor, Danzig led the officers through a scenario in which germ terrorists attacked Washington, D.C. There were a lot of what-ifs, recalled one official. Danzig made the case that investments in the millions, not billions, could help. The military needed anthrax inoculations, more intelligence, better analysis.